Maple Nation, a citizenship guide. There's just one gas station in my community. It's right there at the stoplight. Also the only one. You get the picture. I'm sure that it has an official name, but we just call it the Pompey Mall. Coffee, milk, ice, dog food, you can get most anything essential to life at the mall. Duct tape to hold things together, and WD-40 to get them apart. There are tins of last year's maple syrup, which I pass up, since I'm on my way to the sugar house, where new syrup awaits. The clientele runs largely to pickup trucks, and now and then a Prius. There aren't any snowmobiles revving at the pumps today, because the snow is just about gone. Since it's the only place to fuel up, the lines are often long, and today people stand outside in the spring sunshine, leaning against the cars, waiting their turn. Conversation, like the shelves inside, tend toward essentials. The price of gas, how the sap is running, and who's got their taxes done. Sugaring season and tax season overlap around here. Between the price of gas and the tax man, I'm just about bled dry. Kerm gripes as he replaces the nozzle and wipes his hands on greasy car hearts. Now they want to raise taxes for a windmill down to the school, all on account of global warming. Not on my dime. One of our town officials is ahead of me in line. She's an ample woman, a former social studies teacher at the school, and does not hesitate to wag a finger in the banter. She probably had Kerm in class. You don't like it? Don't complain if you're not there. Show up to the damn meeting. There's still snow under the trees, a bright blanket beneath the gray trunks and the blush of reddening maple buds. Last night, a tiny sliver of moon hung in the deep blue dark of early spring. That new moon ushers in our Anishinaabe New Year, the Zizibasquit Gizis, maple sugar moon. It is when the earth starts to wake up from her well-deserved rest and renews her gifts to the people. To celebrate, I'm going sugaring. I received my census form today. It's on the seat beside me as I drive out through the hills toward the sugar bush. If you took a biologically inclusive census of the people in this town, the maples would outnumber humans 100 to 1. In our Anishinaabe way, we count trees as people, the standing people. Even though the government only counts humans in our township, there's no denying that we live in the nation of maples. There's a beautiful map of bioregions, drawn by an organization dedicated to restoring ancient food traditions. State boundaries disappear and are replaced by ecological regions defined by the leading denizens of the region, the iconic beings who shape the landscape, influence our daily lives, and feed us, both materially and spiritually. The map shows the Salmon Nation of the Pacific Northwest and the Pinyon Nation of the Southwest, among others. We in the Northeast are in the embrace of the Maple Nation. I'm thinking about what it would mean to declare citizenship in Maple Nation. Kerm would probably answer with two terse words of resentment, pay taxes. And he's right. Being a citizen does mean sharing in the support of your community. Here it is, almost tax day, when my fellow humans are getting ready to make their contribution to the well-being of the community. But the maples have been giving all year long. Their contribution of limb wood kept my old neighbor Mr. Keller's house warm all winter when he couldn't pay the oil bill. The volunteer fire department and the ambulance squad as well rely on maple contributions to their monthly pancake breakfast to raise funds for a new engine. The trees make a real dent in the energy bill for the school with their shade. And thanks to big canopies of maples, nobody I know ever pays a bill for air conditioning. They donate shade to the Memorial Day parade every year without even being asked. If it weren't for the maples' ability to break the wind, the highway department would have to plow snowdrifts off the road twice as often. Both of my parents have been active in their town government for years, so I've seen firsthand how stewardship of a community happens. Good communities don't make themselves, my dad said. We've got a lot to be grateful for, and all we have to do is do our part to keep it going. He retired as town supervisor. My mom is on the zoning board. From them, I learned that town government is invisible to most citizens, which is perhaps as it should be. Necessary services are delivered so smoothly that folks just take them for granted. The roads get plowed, the water's kept clean, the parks are kept up, and the new senior citizen center finally got built, all without much fanfare. Most people are indifferent, unless their self-interest is at stake. And then there are the chronic complainers, always on the phone to contest the tax levy and also on the phone to object to cutbacks when the same tax levies fail. Fortunately, there are those in every organization, few but invaluable, who know their responsibilities and seem to thrive on meeting them. They get things done. These are the ones we all rely upon, the people who take care of the rest of us, quiet leaders. My Onondaga Nation neighbors call the maple the leader of the trees. Trees constitute the Environmental Quality Committee, running air and water purification service 24/7. They're on every task force, from the Historical Society picnic to the Highway Department, school board, library. When it comes to civic beautification, they alone create the Crimson Fall with little recognition. We haven't even mentioned how they create habitat for songbirds and wildlife cover, golden leaves to shuffle through, tree forts and branches for swings. Centuries of their falling leaves have built this soil, now farmed for strawberries, apples, sweet corn, and hay. How much of the oxygen in our valley comes from our maples? How much carbon is taken from the atmosphere and stored away? These processes are what ecological scientists term ecosystem services, the structures and functions of the natural world that make life possible. We can assign an economic value to maple timber or gallons of syrup, but ecosystem services are far more precious, and yet these services go unaccounted for in the human economy. As with the services of local government, we don't think about them unless they are missing. There is no official tax system to pay for these services, as we pay for snow plowing and school books. We get them for free, donated continually by maples. They do their share for us. The question is, how well do we do by them? By the time I get to the sugar house, the guys already have the pan at full boil. A forceful plume of steam billows from the open vents, signaling to folks down the road and across the valley that they're boiling today. While I'm there, a steady stream of people drop by for conversation and a gallon of new syrup. As they step into the shed, they all stop right at the door. Their glasses fog up and the sweet aroma of boiling sap stops them in their tracks. I like to walk in and out over and over again just for the rush of fragrance. The sugar house itself is a rough wood building, with a characteristic vented cupola running through its length to allow the steam to escape. It whooshes up to join the downy clouds in a soft spring sky. The fresh sap goes in at one end of the open evaporator and moves along channels under its own increasing gravity as the water is boiled away. The boil at the beginning is wild and frothy with big random bubbles, and more sedate at the end as it thickens, moving from clear at the start to deep caramel at the end. You've got to take the syrup off at just the right time and density. Let it go too far, and the whole affair could crystallize into a delicious brick. It's hard work, and the two guys watching and testing have been here since early morning. I brought along a pie so they can grab forkfuls every now and then between tasks. As we all watch the boil, I ask them my question. What does it mean to be a good citizen of Maple Nation? Larry is the stoker. Every 10 minutes, he pulls on elbow-length gloves and dons a face shield before opening the door to the fire. The heat is intense as he adds another armload of 3-foot lengths of firewood, one by one. You gotta keep it boiling heavy, he says. We do it the old-fashioned way. Some folks have gone to fuel oil or gas burners, but I hope we always stick with wood. It feels right. The woodpile is easily as big as the sugar house itself, stacked 10 feet high with cord upon cord of dry split ash and birch, and of course, good hard maple. The forestry students cut and gather a fair bit of the wood from dead trees along all of the trails. See, it works out good. To keep the sugar bush productive, we thin out the competition so our sap trees can grow a nice full canopy. The trees we thin out usually end up right here, as firewood. Nothing gets wasted. That's kind of being a good citizen, isn't it? You take care of the trees, and they'll take care of you. I don't imagine there are many colleges that run their own sugar bushes, and I'm grateful that ours does. Bart sits by the bottling tank and chimes in. We should save the oil for where we've got to have it. Wood can do this job better. And besides, it's carbon neutral. The carbon we release from burning wood for syrup came from the trees that took it in the first place. It will go right back to them with no net increase. He goes on to explain that these forests are part of the college's plan to be totally carbon neutral. We actually get a tax credit for keeping our forests intact so they can absorb carbon dioxide. I suppose that one of the features of being a member of a nation is shared currency. In Maple Nation, the currency is carbon. It is traded, exchanged, bartered among community members from atmosphere to tree to beetle to woodpecker to fungus to log to firewood to atmosphere and back to tree. No waste. Shared wealth, balance, and reciprocity. What better model for a sustainable economy do we need? What does it mean to be a citizen of Maple Nation? I put this question to Mark, who handles the finishing with a big paddle and the hydrometer to test the sugar concentration. That's a good question, he says, as he pours a few drops of cream onto the boiling syrup to quell the foam. He doesn't answer, but opens the spigot at the bottom of the finishing pan, filling a bucket with new syrup. Later, when it has cooled a bit, he pours out a little cup for each of us, golden and warm, and raises his in a toast. I guess this is what you do, he says. You make syrup. You enjoy it. You take what you're given, and you treat it right. Drinking maple syrup gives you quite a sugar rush. This, too, is what it means to be a citizen of Maple Nation. Having maple in your bloodstream, maple in your bones. We are what we eat, and with every golden spoonful, maple carbon becomes human carbon. Our traditional thinking had it right. Maples are people. People are maples. Our Anishinaabe word for maple is Ananimik, the man tree. My wife makes maple cake, says Mark, and we always give out candy maple leaves at Christmas. Larry's favorite is to just pour it on vanilla ice cream. My 96-year-old grandma likes to take a pure spoonful once in a while when she's feeling low. She calls it vitamin M. Next month, the college will hold a pancake breakfast here, where staff and faculty and families gather to celebrate sticky-fingered membership in Maple Nation, our bond to each other and to this land. Citizens also celebrate together. The pan is running low, so I go with Larry down the road to the sugar bush, where a tank is slowly filling with fresh sap, drip by drip. We walk around the woods for a while, ducking under the network of tubes that gurgle like a brook, carrying the sap inside to the collecting tank. It's not the same plinking music of old-time sap buckets, but enables two people to do the work of 20. The woods are the same as countless springs before this one. The citizens of Maple Nation are starting to wake up. Snow fleas pepper the wells of deer tracks. Mosses drip with snowmelt at the base of trees, and geese race by, their V in disarray with eagerness to be home. As we drive back with a brimming tank, he says, "Of course, sugaring is a gamble every year. It's not like you can control the sap flow. Some years are good and some aren't. You take what you get and be grateful for it. It all depends on the temperature, and that's out of our hands." But that's not entirely true anymore. Our addiction to fossil fuel and current energy policies accelerate carbon dioxide inputs every year, unequivocally causing a global rise in temperatures. Spring comes nearly a week earlier than it did just 20 years ago. I hate to leave, but I've got to get back to my desk. On the drive home, I continue to think about citizenship. When my kids were in school, they had to memorize the Bill of Rights. But I would venture to guess that maple seedlings would be schooled instead in a Bill of Responsibilities. When I get home, I look up the citizenship oaths for various human nations. They have many elements in common. Some require allegiance to a leader. Most are a pledge of loyalty, an expression of shared beliefs, and an oath to obey the laws of the land. The United States rarely permits dual citizenship. You have to choose. On what basis do we select where to invest our allegiance? If I were forced, I would choose Maple Nation. If citizenship is a matter of shared beliefs, then I believe in the democracy of species. If citizenship means an oath of loyalty to a leader, then I choose the leader of the trees. If good citizens agree to uphold the laws of the nation, then I choose natural law, the law of reciprocity, of regeneration, of mutual flourishing. The oath of citizenship for the United States stipulates that citizens will defend the nation against all enemies and take up arms if they are called to do so. If that same oath held in Maple Nation, the trumpet call would be echoing through these wooded hills. Maples of the United States face a grave enemy. The most highly regarded models predict that the climate of New England will become hostile to sugar maples within 50 years. Rising temperatures will reduce seedling success, and regeneration will thereby start to fail. It already is failing. Insects will follow, and the oaks will get the upper hand. Imagine New England without maples. Unthinkable, a brown fall instead of hills of fire. Sugar houses boarded up. No more fragrant clouds of steam. Would we even recognize our homes? Is that a heartbreak we can bear? It's a running threat on the left and the right. If things don't change, I'm moving to Canada. It looks like the maples will have to do just that. Like the displaced farmers of Bangladesh fleeing rising sea levels, maples will become climate refugees. To survive, they must migrate northward to find homes at the boreal fringe. Our energy policy is forcing them to leave. They will be exiled from their homelands for the price of cheap gas. We do not pay at the pump for the cost of climate change, for the loss of ecosystem services provided by maples and others. Cheap gas now, or maples for the next generation? Call me crazy, but I'd welcome the tax that would resolve that question. Individuals far wiser than I have said that we get the government we deserve. That may be true, but the maples, our most generous of benefactors, most responsible of citizens, do not deserve our government. They deserve you and me speaking up on their behalf. To quote our town councilwoman, show up at the damn meeting. Political action, civil engagement, these are powerful acts of reciprocity with the land. The Maple Nation Bill of Responsibilities asks us to stand up for the standing people, to lead with the wisdom of maples. The Honorable Harvest. The crows see me coming across the field, a woman with a basket, and argue my provenance loudly among themselves. The soil's hard under my feet, bare except for a scattering of plow-scraped rocks and a few of last year's corn stalks, their remnant prop roots squatting like bleached-out spider legs. Years of herbicides and continuous corn have left the field sterile. Even in rain-soaked April, not a blade of green shows its face. By August, it will once again be a monoculture of corn plants in straight rows of indentured servitude. But for now, it's my cross-country route to the woods. My entourage of crows leaves me at the stone wall, a loose windrow of glacial cobbles raked from the field to mark its boundary. On the other side, the ground is soft underfoot and deep in centuries of leaf mold. The forest floor flocked with tiny pink spring beauties and clumps of yellow violets. The humus stirs with trout lilies and trillium poised to rise through the winter brown mat of leaves. A wood thrush hangs a silvery trill on the still bare branches of the maples. The dense patches of leeks are among the first to appear in the spring, their green so vivid that they signal like a neon sign, "Pick me!" I resist the urge to answer their call immediately and instead address the plants the way I've been taught, introducing myself in case they've forgotten, even though we've been meeting like this for years. I explain why I've come and ask their permission to harvest, inquiring politely if they would be willing to share. Eating leeks is a spring tonic that blurs the line between food and medicine. It wakens the body from its winter lassitude and quickens the blood. But I have another need, too, that only greens from this particular woods can satisfy. Both of my daughters will be home for the weekend from the far places where they live. I ask these leeks to renew the bonds between this ground and my children so that they will always carry the substance of home in the mineral of their bones. Some of the leaves are already expanded, stretching toward the sun, while others are still rolled into a spear, thrusting up through the duff. I dig my trowel in around the edge of the clump, but they're deeply rooted and tightly packed, resisting my efforts. It's just a small trowel, and it hurts my winter-softened hand, but at last I pry out a clump and shake away the dark earth. I expected a cluster of fat white bulbs, but in their place I find a raggedy paper sheaths where the bulbs should be. Withered and flaccid, they look as if all the juice has already been sucked out of them, which it has. If you ask permission, you have to listen to the answer. I tuck them back in the soil and go home. Along the stone wall, the elderberries have broken bud, and their embryonic leaves reach out like gloved purple hands. On a day like this, when the fiddleheads are unfurling and the air is petal soft, I am awash in longing. I know that thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's chloroplasts. It's good advice, and yet I must confess to full-blown chlorophyll envy. Sometimes I wish I could photosynthesize, so that just by being, just by shimmering at the meadow's edge or floating lazily on a pond, I could be doing the work of the world while standing silent in the sun. The shadowy hemlocks and the waving grasses are spinning out sugar molecules and passing them on to hungry mouths and mandibles, all the while listening to the warblers and watching the light dance on the water. It would be so satisfying to provide for the well-being of others, like being a mother again, like being needed. Shade, medicine, berries, roots, there would be no end to it. As a plant, I could make the campfire, hold the nest, heal the wound, fill the brimming pot. But this generosity is beyond my realm, as I am a mere heterotroph, a feeder on the carbon transmuted by others. In order to live, I must consume. That's the way the world works, the exchange of a life for a life, the endless cycling between my body and the body of the world. Forced to choose, I must admit I actually like my heterotroph role. Besides, if I could photosynthesize, I couldn't eat leeks. So instead, I live vicariously through the photosynthesis of others. I am not the vibrant leaves on the forest floor. I am the woman with the basket, and how I fill it is a question that matters. If we are fully awake, a moral question arises as we extinguish the other lives around us on behalf of our own. Whether we are digging wild leeks or going to the mall, how do we consume in a way that does justice to the lives that we take? In our oldest stories, we are reminded that this was a question of profound concern for our ancestors. When we rely deeply on other lives, there's urgency to protect them. Our ancestors, who had so few material possessions, devoted a great deal of attention to this question, while we, who are drowning in possessions, scarcely give it a thought. The cultural landscape may have changed, but the conundrum has not. The need to resolve the inescapable tension between honoring life around us and taking it in order to live is part of being human. A few weeks later, I take up my basket and again cross the field, still bare, while the earth on the other side of the wall is drifted in snowy white trillium blossoms like a late season snowfall. I must look like a ballet dancer tiptoeing and spinning between clumps of delicate Dutchman's breeches, mysterious blue shoots of cohosh, patches of bloodroot, and the green shoots of Jack in the Pulpit and Mayapple surging up through the leaves. I greet them one by one and feel as if they're glad to see me too. We are told to take only that which is given. And when I was here last, the leeks had nothing to give. Bulbs hold energy saved up for the next generation, like money in the bank. Last fall, the bulbs were sleek and fat, but in the first days of spring, that savings account gets depleted as the roots send their stored energy into the emerging leaves to fuel their journey from soil to sunshine. In their first few days, the leaves are consumers, taking from the root, shriveling it up, and giving nothing back. But as they unfurl, they become a powerful solar array that will recharge the energy of the roots, playing out the reciprocity between consuming and producing in a few short weeks. The leeks today are twice the size they were on my first visit, and the scent of onions is strong where a deer has bruised the leaves. I pass by the first clump and kneel by the second. Once again, I quietly ask permission. Asking permission shows respect for the personhood of the plant, but it is also an assessment of the well-being of the population. Thus, I must use both sides of my brain to listen to the answer. The analytic left reads the empirical signs to judge whether the population is large and healthy enough to sustain a harvest, whether it has enough to share. The intuitive right hemisphere is reading something else, a sense of generosity, an open-handed radiance that says, "Take me," or sometimes a tight-lipped recalcitrance that makes me put my trowel away. I can't explain it, but it's a kind of knowing that is for me just as compelling as a no trespassing sign. This time, when I push my trowel deep, I come up with a thick cluster of gleaming white bulbs, plump, slippery, and aromatic. I hear yes. So I make a gift from the soft old tobacco pouch in my pocket and begin to dig. Leeks are clonal plants that multiply by division, spreading the patch wider and wider. As a result, they tend to become crowded in the center of the patch, so I try to harvest there. In this way, my taking can help the growth of the remaining plants by thinning them out. From camas bulbs to sweetgrass, blueberries to basket willow, our ancestors found ways to harvest that bring long-term benefit to plants and people. While a sharp shovel would make digging more efficient, the truth is that it makes the work too fast. If I could get all the leeks I needed in 5 minutes, I'd lose that time on my knees, watching the ginger poke up and listening to the oriole that has just returned home. This is truly a choice for slow food. Besides, that simple shift in technology would also make it easy to slice through neighboring plants and take too much. Woods throughout the country are losing their leeks to harvesters who love them to extinction. The difficulty of digging is an important constraint. Not everything should be convenient. The traditional ecological knowledge of indigenous harvesters is rich in prescriptions for sustainability. They are found in native science and philosophy, in life ways and practices, but most of all in stories, the ones that are told to help restore balance, to locate ourselves once again in the circle. Anishinaabe elder Basil Johnston tells of the time our teacher, Nana Bojo, was fishing in the lake for supper, as he often did, with hook and line. Heron came striding along through the reeds on his long, bent legs, his beak like a spear. Heron is a good fisherman and a sharing friend, so he told Nana Bojo about a new way to fish that would make his life much easier. Heron cautioned him to be careful not to take too many fish, but Nana Bojo was already thinking of a feast. He went out early the next day and soon had a whole basket full of fish, so heavy he could barely carry it, and far more than he could eat. So he cleaned all those fish and set them out to dry on the racks outside his lodge. The next day, with his belly still full, he went back to the lake and again did what Heron had showed him. "Ah," he thought as he carried home the fish, "I will have plenty to eat this winter." Day after day he stuffed himself, and as the lake grew empty, his drying racks grew full, sending out a delicious smell into the forest where fox was licking his lips. Again he went to the lake, so proud of himself. But that day his nets came up empty, and Heron looked down at him as he flew over the lake with a critical eye. When Nana Bojo got home to his lodge, he learned a key rule. Never take more than you need. The racks of fish were toppled in the dirt, and every bite was gone. Cautionary tales of the consequences of taking too much are ubiquitous in native cultures, but it's hard to recall a single one in English. Perhaps this helps to explain why we seem to be caught in a trap of overconsumption, which is as destructive to ourselves as to those we consume. Collectively, the indigenous canon of principles and practices that govern the exchange of life for life is known as the honorable harvest. They are rules of sorts that govern our taking, shape our relationships with the natural world, and rein in our tendency to consume, that the world might be as rich for the seventh generation as it is for our own. The details are highly specific to different cultures and ecosystems, but the fundamental principles are nearly universal among people who live close to the land. I am a student of this way of thinking, not a scholar. As a human being who cannot photosynthesize, I must struggle to participate in the honorable harvest. So I lean in close to watch and listen to those who are far wiser than I am. What I share here, in the same way that they shared with me, are seeds gleaned from the fields of their collective wisdom, the barest surface, the moss on the mountains of their knowledge. I feel grateful for their teachings and responsible for passing them on as best I can. My friend is the town clerk in a small Adirondack village. In the summer and fall, there is a line outside her door for fishing and hunting licenses. With every laminated card, she hands out the harvesting regulations, pocket-sized booklets on thin newsprint, printed in black and white, except for glossy inserts with photos of the actual prey, just in case people don't know what they're shooting at. It happens. Every year there's a story about triumphal deer hunters being stopped on the highway with a Jersey calf tied to their bumper. A friend of mine once worked at a hunting check station during partridge season. A guy drove up in a big white Oldsmobile and proudly opened his trunk for inspection of his take. The birds were all neatly laid out on a canvas sheet, lined up beak to back with plumage scarcely ruffled. A whole brace of yellow-shafted flickers. Traditional peoples who feed their families from the land have harvest guidelines too. Detailed protocols designed to maintain the health and vigor of wildlife species. Like the state regulations, they too are based on sophisticated ecological knowledge and long-term monitoring of populations. They share the common goal of protecting what hunting managers call the resource, both for its own sake and to safeguard the sustainable supply for future generations. Early colonists on Turtle Island were stunned by the plenitude of food they found here, attributing the richness to the bounty of nature. Settlers in the Great Lakes wrote in their journals about the extraordinary abundance of wild rice harvested by native peoples. In just a few days, they could fill their canoes with enough rice to last all year. But the settlers were puzzled by the fact that, as one of them wrote, the savages stopped gathering long before all the rice was harvested. She observed that the rice harvest starts with a ceremony of thanksgiving and prayers for good weather for the next 4 days. They will harvest dawn till dusk for the prescribed 4 days and then stop, often leaving much rice to stand unreaped. This rice, they say, is not for them, but for the thunders. Nothing will compel them to continue. Therefore, much goes to waste. The settlers took this as certain evidence of laziness and lack of industry on the part of the heathens. They didn't understand how indigenous land care practices might contribute to the wealth they encountered. I once met an engineering student visiting from Europe who told me excitedly about going ricing in Minnesota with his friend's Ojibwe family. He was eager to experience a bit of Native American culture. They were on the lake by dawn, and all day long they poled through the rice beds, knocking the ripe seed into the canoe. It didn't take long to collect quite a bit, he reported, but it's not very efficient. At least half of the rice just falls in the water, and they didn't seem to care. It's wasted. As a gesture of thanks to his hosts, a traditional ricing family, he offered to design a grain capture system that could be attached to the gunwales of their canoes. He sketched it out for them, showing how his technique could get 85% more rice. His hosts listened respectfully and then said, "Yes, we could get more that way, but it's got to seed itself for next year, and what we leave behind isn't wasted. You know, we're not the only ones who like rice. Do you think the ducks would stop here if we took it all?" Our teachings tell us to never take more than half. When my basket holds enough leeks for dinner, I head home. Walking back through the flowers, I see a whole patch of snake root spreading its glistening leaves, which reminds me of a story told by an herbalist I know. She taught me one of the cardinal rules of gathering plants. Never take the first plant you find, as it might be the last, and you want that first one to speak well of you to the others of her kind. That's not too hard to do when you come upon a whole stream bank of coltsfoot, when there's a third and a fourth right behind the first. But it's harder when the plants are few and the desire is great. Once I dreamed of a snake root, that I should bring it with me on a journey the next day. There was a need, but I didn't know what it was. But it was still too early to harvest. The leaves wouldn't be up for another week or so. There was a chance it might be up early somewhere, maybe in a sunny spot, so I went to look in the usual place I pick those medicines, the herbalist recalled for me. The bloodroot was out, and the spring beauties, too. She greeted them as she walked past, but saw none of the plant she sought. She stepped more slowly, opening her awareness, making her whole self into a halo of peripheral vision. Nestled at the base of a maple on the southeast side, the snake root made itself visible, a glossy mass of dark green leaves. She knelt, smiling, and spoke quietly. She thought of her upcoming journey, the empty bag in her pocket, and then slowly rose to her feet. Though her knees were stiff with age, she walked away, refraining from taking the first one. She wandered through the woods, admiring the trillium just poking their heads up, and the leeks. But there was no more snake root. I just figured I'd have to do without. I was halfway home when I found I'd lost my little shovel, the one I always use for digging medicine, so I had to go back. Well, I found it all right. It's got a red handle, so it's easy to find. And you know, it had fallen from my pocket, right in a patch of root. So I talked to that plant, addressed it just like you would a person whose help you need, and it gave me a bit of itself. When I got where I was going, sure enough, there was a woman there who needed that snake root medicine, and I could pass on the gift. That plant reminded me that if we harvest with respect, the plants will help us. The guidelines for the honorable harvest are not written down, or even consistently spoken of as a whole. They're reinforced in small acts of daily life. But if you were to list them, they might look something like this. Know the ways of the ones who take care of you, so that you may take care of them. Introduce yourself. Be accountable as the one who comes asking for life. Ask permission before taking. Abide by the answer. Never take the first. Never take the last. Take only what you need. Take only that which is given. Never take more than half. Leave some for others. Harvest in a way that minimizes harm. Use it respectfully. Never waste what you have taken. Share. Give thanks for what you have been given. Give a gift in reciprocity for what you have taken. Sustain the ones who sustain you, and the earth will last forever. The state guidelines on hunting and gathering are based exclusively in the biophysical realm, while the rules of the honorable harvest are based on accountability to both the physical and the metaphysical worlds. The taking of another life to support your own is far more significant when you recognize the beings who are harvested as persons, non-human persons, vested with awareness, intelligence, spirit, and who have families waiting for them at home. Killing a who demands something different than killing an it. When you regard those non-human persons as kinfolk, another set of harvesting regulations extends beyond bag limits and legal seasons. The state regulations are, by and large, lists of illegal practices. It is unlawful to keep a rainbow trout whose length from snout to posterior fin does not exceed 12 inches. The consequences for breaking the law are clearly stipulated and involve a financial transaction after a visit with your friendly conservation officer. Unlike the state laws, the Honorable Harvest is not an enforced legal policy, but it is an agreement nonetheless, among people, and most especially between consumers and providers. The providers have the upper hand. The deer, the sturgeon, the berries, and the leeks say, "If you follow these rules, we will continue to give our lives so that you may live." Imagination is one of our most powerful tools. What we imagine we can become. I like to imagine what it would be like if the Honorable Harvest were the law of the land today, as it was in our past. Imagine if a developer, eyeing open land for a shopping mall, had to ask the goldenrod, the meadowlarks, and the monarch butterflies for permission to take their homeland. What if he had to abide by the answer? Why not? I like to imagine a laminated card, like the one my friend the town clerk hands out with hunting and fishing licenses, embossed with the rules of the Honorable Harvest. Everyone would be subject to the same laws, since they are, after all, the dictates of the real government, the democracy of species, the laws of Mother Nature. When I ask my elders about the ways our people lived in order to keep the world whole and healthy, I hear the mandate to take only what you need. But we human people, descendants of Nana Bojo, struggle as he did, with self-restraint. The dictum to take only what you need leaves a lot of room for interpretation when our needs get so tangled with our wants. This gray area yields then to a rule more primal than need, an old teaching nearly forgotten now in the din of industry and technology. Deeply rooted in cultures of gratitude, this ancient rule is not just to take only what you need, but to take only that which is given. At the level of human interactions, we already do this. It's what we teach our kids. If you're visiting your sweet grandma and she offers you homemade cookies on her favorite china plate, you know what to do. You accept them with many thank yous and cherish the relationship reinforced by cinnamon and sugar. You gratefully take what has been given. But you wouldn't dream of breaking into her pantry and just taking all the cookies without invitation, grabbing her china plate for good measure. That would be, at a minimum, a breach of good manners, a betrayal of the loving relationship. What's more, your grandma would be heartbroken and not inclined to bake more cookies for you anytime soon. As a culture, though, we seem unable to extend these good manners to the natural world. The dishonorable harvest has become a way of life. We take what doesn't belong to us and destroy it beyond repair. Onondaga Lake, the Alberta tar sands, the rainforests of Malaysia, the list is endless. They are gifts from our sweet grandmother Earth, which we take without asking. How do we find the honorable harvest again? If we're picking berries or gathering nuts, taking only what is given makes a lot of sense. They offer themselves, and by taking them, we fulfill our reciprocal responsibility. After all, the plants have made these fruits with the express purpose of our taking them, to disperse and plant. By our use of their gifts, both species prosper, and life is magnified. But what about when something is taken without a clear avenue for mutual benefit? When someone is going to lose? How can we distinguish between that which is given by the earth and that which is not? When does taking become outright theft? I think my elders would counsel that there's no one path, that each of us must find our own way. In my wandering with this question, I've found dead ends and clear openings. Discerning all that it might mean is like bushwhacking through dense undergrowth. Sometimes I get faint glimpses of a deer trail. It's hunting season. and we were sitting on the porch of the cookhouse at Onondaga on a hazy October day. The leaves are smoky gold and fluttering down while we listen to the men tell stories. Jake, with a red bandana around his hair, gets everybody laughing with a story about Junior's never-fail turkey call. With his feet on the railing and black braid hanging over the back of his chair, Kent tells about following a blood trail over new fallen snow, bear tracking, and the one that got away. For the most part, they're young men with reputations to build, along with one elder. In a seventh-generation ball cap and a thin gray ponytail, Oren gets his turn at a story and leads us along with him through thickets and down ravines to get to his favorite hunting spot. Smiling in recollection, he says, "I must have seen 10 deer that day, but I only took one shot." He tips his chair back and looks at the hill, remembering. The young men listen, looking intently at the porch floor. The first one came crunching through the dry leaves, but was shielded by the brush as it wove down the hill. It never saw me sitting there. Then a young buck came moving upwind toward me and then stepped behind a boulder. I could have tracked it and followed it across the creek, but I knew it wasn't the one. Deer by deer, he recounts the day's encounters, for which he never even raised his rifle. The doe by the water, the three-pointer concealed behind a basswood with only its rump showing. "I only take one bullet with me," he says. The young men in T-shirts lean forward on the bench across from him. And then, without explanation, there's one who walks right into the clearing and looks you in the eye. He knows full well that you're there and what you're doing. He turns his flank right toward you for a clear shot. I know he's the one, and so does he. There's a kind of nod exchanged. That's why I only carry one shot. I wait for the one. He gave himself to me. That's what I was taught. Take only what is given, and then treat it with respect. Oren reminds his listeners, that's why we thank the deer as the leader of the animals, for its generosity in feeding the people. Acknowledging the lives that support ours and living in a way that demonstrates our gratitude is a force that keeps the world in motion. The Honorable Harvest does not ask us to photosynthesize. It does not say, don't take, but offers inspiration and a model for what we should take. It's not so much a list of do nots as a list of do's. Do eat food that is honorably harvested and celebrate every mouthful. Do use technologies that minimize harm. Do take what is given. This philosophy guides not only our taking of food, but also any taking of the gifts of Mother Earth, air, water, and the literal body of the earth, the rocks and soil and fossil fuels. Taking coal buried deep in the earth, for which we must inflict irreparable damage, violates every precept of the code. By no stretch of the imagination is coal given to us. We have to wound the land and water to gouge it from Mother Earth. What if a coal company planning mountaintop removal in the ancient folds of the Appalachians were compelled by law to take only that which is given? Don't you long to hand them the laminated card and announce that the rules have changed? It doesn't mean that we can't consume the energy we need, but it does mean that we honorably take only what is given. The wind blows every day. Every day the sun shines. Every day the waves roll against the shore and the earth is warm below us. We can understand these renewable sources of energy as given to us, since they are the sources that have powered life on the planet for as long as there has been a planet. We need not destroy the earth to make use of them. Solar, wind, geothermal, and tidal energy, the so-called clean energy harvests, when they are widely used, seems to me to be consistent with the ancient rules of the honorable harvest. And the code might ask of any harvest, including energy, that our purpose be worthy of the harvest. Oren's deer made moccasins and fed three families. What will we use our energy for? I once gave a lecture titled Cultures of Gratitude at a small private college where tuition ran upwards of $40,000 a year. For the allocated 55 minutes, I talked about the Thanksgiving address of the Haudenosaunee, the potlatch tradition of the Pacific Northwest, and the gift economies of Polynesia. Then I told a traditional story of the years when the corn harvests were so plentiful that the caches were full. The fields had been so generous with the villagers that the people scarcely needed to work. So they didn't. Hoes leaned against a tree, idle. The people became so lazy that they let the time for corn ceremonies go by without a single song of gratitude. They began to use the corn in ways the three sisters had not intended. When they gave the people corn as a sacred gift of food, they burned it for fuel when they couldn't be bothered to cut firewood. The dogs dragged it off from the untidy heaps the people made instead of storing the harvest in secure granaries. No one stopped the kids when they kicked ears around the village in their games. Saddened by the lack of respect, the corn spirit decided to leave, to go where she would be appreciated. At first, the people didn't even notice. But the next year, the cornfields were nothing but weeds. The caches were nearly empty, and the grain that had been left untended was moldy and mouse-chewed. There was nothing to eat. The people sat about in despair, growing thinner and thinner. When they abandoned gratitude, the gifts abandoned them. One small child walked out from the village and wandered for hungry days until he found the corn spirit in a sunlit clearing in the woods. He begged her to return to his people. She smiled kindly at him and instructed him to teach his people the gratitude and respect that they had forgotten. Only then would she return. He did as she asked, and after a hard winter without corn to remind them of the cost, she returned to them in the spring. Several students in my audience yawned. They could not imagine such a thing. The aisles of the grocery store were always well stocked. At a reception afterward, the students filled their styrofoam plates with the usual fare. We exchanged questions and comments while we balanced plastic cups of punch. The students grazed on cheese and crackers, a profusion of cut vegetables and buckets of dip. There was enough food to feast a small village. The leftovers were swept into trash bins, placed conveniently next to the tables. A beautiful young girl, dark hair tied up in a headscarf, was hanging back from the discussion, waiting her turn. When nearly everyone had left, she approached me, gesturing with an apologetic smile at the wasted remains of the reception. "I don't want you to think no one understands what you were saying," she said. "I do. You sound like my grandmother, back in my village in Turkey. I will tell her she must have a sister here in the United States. The honorable harvest is her way, too. In her house, we learned that everything we put in our mouths, everything that allows us to live, is the gift of another life. I remember lying with her at night as she made us thank the rafters of her house and the wool blankets we slept in. My grandma wouldn't let us forget that these are all gifts, which is why you take care of everything to show respect for that life. In my grandmother's house, we were taught to kiss the rice. If a single grain fell to the ground, we learned to pick it up and kiss it to show we meant no disrespect in wasting it. The student told me that when she came to the United States, the greatest culture shock she experienced was not language or food or technology, but waste. "I've never told anyone before," she said, "but the cafeteria made me sick because of the way people treated their food. What people throw away here after one lunch would supply my village for days. I could not speak to anyone of this. No one else would understand to kiss the grain of rice." I thanked her for her story. And she said, "Please, take it as a gift and give it to someone else." I've heard it said that sometimes, in return for the gifts of the earth, gratitude is enough. It is our uniquely human gift to express thanks, because we have the awareness and the collective memory to remember that the world could well be otherwise, less generous than it is. But I think we are called to go beyond cultures of gratitude, to once again become cultures of reciprocity.